This week on Pirate Party Radio, anti-net neutrality front group reveals upcoming tactics. Man ordered in court case to pay $100 due to unsecured Wi-Fi. And the FCC allows the MPAA to disable the AV ports on your media devices. This is Pirate Party Radio, episode 28 for Thursday, May 13th, 2010.
We are under siege. They are doing everything they can to prevent progress, to prevent the spread of culture, and to prevent privacy as we know it. The only way to stop this is to unite. This is definitely a global movement. It's continuing to spread across the world like wildfire. We are seeing the birth of a new global political power. There is no way to control the information. There is no way to control culture, control knowledge. And those who control culture, knowledge, control the world. And that is losing its last cohorts. People don't understand how big this really is.
I'm James O'Brien, and welcome to Pirate Party Radio, the official show of the Pirate Party of Canada and the U.S., your source for news around the world on copyright, net neutrality, open government, free culture and speech, patents, privacy, and more. Make sure you check out the Pirate Party Radio forums for all the links to the news stories mentioned during the show. And I've got some incoming messages from Coffee Gone Wrong. After listening to the story from two podcasts ago about Google in Germany logging MAC addresses for routers, when you use an iPod, iPhone, and iPad, it uses the Skyhook service to locate you. This service is based off a database of MAC addresses. It's been around for years. Shouldn't people have been worried before this? Well, exactly. They should have been worried before this, exactly for the same thing. Skyhook is exactly the same thing. I looked it up, and I remember hearing about this a couple years ago. They have a database of the MAC addresses associated with GPS locations. They have the exact same database that Google is collecting. So this is nothing new. And it is something that we should be worried about. Anytime an organization goes around and collects large amounts of data, presumably on pretty much everyone in the whole region, and makes it accessible through to third parties for amounts that you can pay for, even, or makes it accessible to the populace at large, there's something to be concerned about that it's that accessible. And I pose the question, is this something new? Is this something that we should be concerned about in general? Because it's just It's data that's being accessible in an easier to get to format. Anybody can go around and drive their car through the city, or even walk around the city and get this exact same information that Google is. It's the fact that it's being made in a easy to get to database of the whole world's information all at once is really what's scaring people. But should it scare people? Is it scary that this kind of data is easily accessible and searchable rather than you having to go and do it yourself? Now, what's the difference, really? And that's what I'm posing to you guys out there. What is the difference between you doing it and a corporation doing it, and both of these things being accessible in a database if you put it on the internet or Google put it on the internet? Is the evil part coming in where they're making money off of it? Or maybe that's the price that we have to pay for this kind of information being accessible to us. That's the model that Google bases their company on, is making large amounts of data, the aggregation of the world's data, accessible to your fingertips for the price of advertising. And is this a good or evil or ambivalent kind of thing that Google is doing? They're providing a service for people who want the service, and you're getting what you want from Google, and they're providing it to you. So where's the problem that's coming in here? Is it the problem that things are too accessible? They're too easy to get to? Crawling the web yourself was always available. You could do it yourself, and people have been doing it for years. All these search engines have done it for years. Where's the evil that Google is coming in and doing it? And for that matter of fact, this information that people are giving to Facebook or Google themselves Is this evil inherently? People are giving up this data, or is the evil coming in where people are not understanding what they're giving up, even though they're laying out exactly what the terms and agreements are when you sign up for these services? Or is, or in terms of Google browsing the web and going through your data where you post a, something on a web page, is that an expected breach? Is that an expected expected privacy that you don't have once you put your stuff up on the internet? It is accessible to everyone, but is it something that you expect that somebody's going to store in a database that you've put it up somewhere in a public place? Now, people will argue, it's public, therefore it is public. Public is public. Unless you keep it to yourself and you've locked it away, it's public. So let's go on to the next one from DC regarding the Canada-style DMCA that I talked about last week. If the anti-consumer copyright bill were to pass, fair dealing, which is fair use, the term for fair use that the U.S. has, we have fair dealing in Canada, as a concept in copyright law would be history. This includes use of copyrighted material by educational institutes and the media, which is myself because I'm in Canada. It also means that every image my friend's animation site would basically constitute copyright infringement, despite the fact that she's using those images to promote animation for the big studios. It's a farce, he concludes. It is. Anything that goes through that's such a heavy-handed approach to copyright is going to stifle innovation. It's going to it's going to pretty much shut down this show. I wouldn't be able to talk about any of these articles that I'm bringing up except in a, you know, cursory kind of mentioning it way. I wouldn't be able to outline what I found on the internet every week. And I wouldn't be able to possibly even link to videos or link to these newspapers that are presenting these articles, because everything is under copyright. So every web page, just as his friend's animation site, she wouldn't be able to put that information on the internet and outline how animation works without giving examples. She would have to do all original work and not be able to be able to go under the fair dealing concept or fair use in the United States to be able to enhance the information that she's presenting on the internet. And it's going to stifle creativity. Fair use and fair dealing were set up so it would spur creativity and be able to, for people to use works that people have made in the past and build upon them to make new works without doing large amounts of harm to the people that have created those works in the past, the copyrighted works. And this from Weird Wolf regarding this week's guilty verdict against LimeWire. I'm not going to go over that story, but you can look it up for yourself. LimeWire was handed a sentence by the court that they were found guilty for copyright infringement, not directly themselves, but more facilitating the copyright infringement. Weird Wolf says, seems that LimeWire that runs off the Nutella network is finally gotten taken down by the music and movie companies. And they're also holding the former CEO of the company personally liable for the infringement, which is new. They have not gotten to the penalty phase of how much this company is going to have to pay. But with the music and movie industry is looking at every conceivable way to put an axe into Nutella and other peer-to-peer network technologies to make them accountable for writing or promotion of this software and to be legally held as to how it's used. This is really getting ridiculous. And it is getting ridiculous. And I read today somewhere in one of the articles that I was going through to preparing the show that it's really all about the bottom line. It's not about these companies that are they're evil, they don't like sharing and things like this. It's all about the bottom line. It's all about the money and their perception of the rights that they hold as a company. So it shows that they're to the shareholders that they're doing something about their copyright infringement and the pirates out there. And they're going after everything they can because they have the deep pockets to do so. And they're just grasping at straws because they don't know any other way to make money. They're used to the way they're making money for all the years that they've been going through and doing their making their media. And they're not really ready to innovate. They're rather just because it's been successful to take people to, well, it really hasn't been successful taking people to court, but it's all they know is to take people to court and to sue them and to breed fear into the public so the public will fear downloading movies off the internet, or that's their hope, but it hasn't worked, so I'm not sure why they continue to press it. All they're doing is garnering bad image for themselves in the public and wasting money and giving all their money to the lawyers. But if you'd like to contact me, ask a question, or leave a comment, head over to the Pirate Party Radio site at piratepartyradio.com and fill out the feedback form. Let's get into the news. Copyright news from Germany. This one is frightening. Germans to get fined for not securing Wi-Fi networks. Sent in by Mind Inversion. Germany's top criminal court ruled Wednesday that internet users need to secure their private wireless connections by password to prevent unauthorized people from using their web access to illegally download data. Internet users can be fined up to 100 euro if a third party takes advantage of their unprotected Wi-Fi LAN connection to illegally download music or other files, a Karlsruhe-based court said in its verdict. Private users are obligated to check whether their wireless connection is adequately secured to the danger of unauthorized third parties abusing it to commit copyright violation, the court said. But the court stopped short of holding the users responsible for the illegal content the third party downloaded themselves. The court also limited its decision, ruling that the users could not be expected to constantly update their wireless connection security. They're only required to protect their internet access by setting up a password when they first install it. The National Consumer Protection Agency said the verdict was balanced. Spokeswoman Carolina Ebricks told the German news agency DAPD that it made sense that users should install protection for their wireless connection and that at the same time it was fair of the court not to expect constant technical updates by private users. The ruling came after a musician who the court did not identify sued an internet user whose wireless connection was used illegally to download a song, which was subsequently offered on an online file sharing network. But the user could prove that he was on vacation while the song was downloaded via his wireless connection. Still, the court ruled that he was responsible to a degree for failing to protect his connection from abuse by third parties. About 26 million homes in Germany have wireless internet access, according to Bitkom, the German Association for Information Technology, Telecommunications, and New Media. Well, this is a new innovation in the war on copyright infringement. I walked down the street the other day in my neighborhood with a wireless scanner, which is on my phone. Any phone can, it's built into it. Any phone with Wi-Fi, you can download a program and, you know, green dots will appear on your phone on the map and you can see where all the open Wi-Fi is. Now, if you want to get people going to court, all you have to do is walk down the street, start downloading things off of their Wi-Fi connection. All of a sudden, there's hundreds of people hauled into court and being fined hundreds of dollars for each instance that they haven't secured their network. Well, on one hand, securing your network is a very good idea, because you don't know what's going on through your network or if somebody's even damaging your network itself. But on the other hand, are people liable to... should they secure their own network? And to what degree should they secure their network? There's very, very old security provisions within wireless routers that are completely broken years and years ago, like WEP, that is totally ineffective and can be broken within minutes and somebody can get through it. Would the court rule that this is adequate security? It's something that's built in. They put a password on it. It is an established security connection for a Wi-Fi router. Are they going to say that this is not adequate because you put in a password? Or are they going to say, well, you must secure it with this level of protection, like WPA2 or something to that degree or higher? Are they going to rule that a certain level is not protected and a certain level is protected? Well, obviously, they've ruled in Germany, so everybody in Germany that's listening to this, don't have your Wi-Fi open. I'm sure everybody that is listening to this wouldn't have an open Wi-Fi. But this is an interesting development in the war on copyright infringement. And is this going to extend out to all the Wi-Fi cafes out there that they can't have open wireless anymore for their customers? They're going to have to lock it down, or they're going to be fined every time somebody does something bad through their network? Do you want to be liable for anything that somebody does through your network? If somebody's able to crack through it, they're going to rule against you saying, well, you didn't do it good enough. You didn't secure your Wi-Fi router good enough. So you're going to be fined for whatever this guy did, or just some arbitrary number that doesn't even make sense or has no bearing upon, you know, the song that was downloaded. That's a very expensive song, 100 euros for one song. A little bit out of whack if this guy is going after one song, this artist. Maybe you should go for the $1 that's you can buy songs anywhere on the internet for. That would be a little bit more reasonable. But really, it's all about sending a message. Free culture news from Australia. Electronic Arts head accuses Australia of video game censorship. That's a little bit obvious. Sent in by Steve. The head of one of the world's largest computer game publishers has accused Australia of censoring video games. You don't say. Frank Gibbo, the head of interactive powerhouse EA Games, weighed into the debate on whether games in Australia should be granted an R18 plus rating by writing an open letter to the government criticizing its lack of support for the adult rating. Mr. Gibbo's comments come on the eve of the Standing Committee of Attorney Generals, which begins today and is expected to address the R18 plus rating proposal, which has been actually stalled now, and they've put it off. Australia is one of the few Western nations in the world which doesn't have an adult rating for games. It'll take a unanimous verdict by all 7 state representatives to change the classification. More than 90,000 signatures have been collected in a petition calling for an R18 plus rating by the game retailers EB Game, Game and Review website PALGN, and delivered to each state's attorney general. Mr. Gibbo said the current policy forcing developers to rewrite game code was censorship. Government policies that don't allow for rating of mature content in video games effectively censor entertainment choices for adults. It is that plain. They are having to rewrite their game based on government policies that they're not allowed to show certain things to the populace of Australia. That is the bottom line. That is what censorship is called. And people always argue that, you know, if you can't post something on a forum, or, you know, this person got kicked off of Facebook, that's not censorship, people always say, because it's not the government doing it. It's a private corporation. You can take your picture elsewhere. You can host your text elsewhere in your own site. But when the government does it to a whole country, that is, you can't say any more succinctly that that is censorship on the highest level. You can't go any further than that. The government is saying, no, your game is not allowed in our country to be played by adults. It's a game. A game is banned in Australia, even from adults. These policies show a poor understanding of today's video game audience. Existing legislation in Australia that limits age ratings of games to 16 demonstrates a distance between those policies and the reality of the video game industry and the people that play interactive games in Australia today. I wish I had at my fingertips the demographics of game players in Australia. I wish they put it in this article on how big of a population play games that are over 16 in Australia. I bet it's the majority of game players are over 16 in Australia, and I bet they are in North America as well. I wish I had those stats at my fingertips right now. I'm sure somebody out there can look it up and see the statistics of the game-buying population, and it shows that adults are the majority of the game buyers out there because they have the money to play to buy the games. Mr. Gibbo said adult consumers were entitled to be responsible for their own entertainment choices, and the classification for system for films have done a good job protecting children from inappropriate content. The spectrum of gamers is as wide as the viewership of television, movies, theater, and the readers of books, he said. Governments don't insist that all books be written for children or that all television shows be cartoons. Adult gamers want their governments to treat them with the same respect as they get moviegoers and book readers. adult Australians should be allowed to choose the games they play, including those with mature themes. Mr. Gabo also warned the existing Australian policy towards gaming classification should also have a negative impact, financial impact, on the many talented local developers. Policymakers should consider the environment they create for game makers. Governments that design policies hostile to game developers and their creative medium will struggle to attract investment from the global industry. Free speech news from Canada. National Post loses secret source case. Senated by Nephilim, the Supreme Court of Canada says journalists have no constitutional right to protect confidential sources at all costs in a ruling against the National Post that could have major implications for press freedom. The top court ruled 8-1 against the newspaper and journalist Andrew McIntosh in a case linked to the 10-year-old so-called Shannongate scandal that involved former Prime Minister Jean Chrétien in a hotel in his home writing and questionable bank documents. McIntosh and the Post were attempting to quash a secret warrant issued nearly 10 years ago in the case that would have forced them to provide RCMP with the documents, which McIntosh obtained from a confidential source known as X. The law should and does accept in that some situations the public interest in protecting the secret source from disclosure outweighs other competing public interest, including criminal investigation. Justice Ian Bin wrote on the Ottawa-based court's behalf in a ruling released on Friday. In those circumstances, a court will recognize an immunity against disclosure of sources whom confidentiality has been promised. McIntosh, who no longer works for the National Post, promised X confidentiality and stored the documents in a safe place. RCMP sought the documents via a search warrant after the Business Development Bank of Canada called them forgeries. The Supreme Court's justice and claims of immunity can be argued on a case-by-case basis, but there is no broad legal protection to shield sources. In certain cases, such as this one, the court said the police investigation needs override confidentiality. So this is exactly why WikiLeaks and the free press haven being set up in Iceland is a great idea, so that whistleblowers will not be afraid to speak out against the government and corporations, because if this... cases like this go through where they're forced, they have search warrants to look for the documents that newspapers are getting from confidential sources. Nobody is going to speak up and speak out against their bosses, the government, or anybody else, because they're going to be feared of being outed in the public, in the court system. And then none of this kind of shenanigans or underhanded dealings or, you know, shady things going on are ever going to be revealed by the whistleblowers. It's going to be very difficult to go after the bad guys if people are not willing to stand forward and stand up and say and point, this is the bad guy, this is what he's doing, because they're not going to risk their own neck. But if we have a WikiLeaks and a free press place that's being trying to be set up in Iceland with laws that protect whistleblowers, then people are going to be able to stand up and say something is wrong here without fear of retribution from companies and governments. And I think that is a good thing, especially, you know, people always say, well, we need to make sure that these are real documents. Well, if the data stands up for itself, then you don't need to know who brought forth the data. It's all about the data itself and the information that they're bringing forward. If that could be corroborated, that the information is truthful and it makes sense and it can stand up, then it speaks for itself and you don't need to know the name of the person who brought it forward. Free culture news from the U.S. The FCC allows blocking of set-top box outputs sent in by D.C. They're locking down the equipment you bought yet again. Federal regulators are endorsing Hollywood's efforts to let cable and satellite TV companies turn off output connections on the back of set-top boxes to prevent illegal copying of movies. The decision by the Federal Communications Commission, announced late Friday, is intended to encourage studios to make movies available for home viewing on demand soon after they hit theaters or even at the same time. Bob Pisano, head of the Motion Picture Association of America, said the FCC's actions will give consumers far greater access to see recent high-definition movies in their homes. But critics warned the FCC order could prevent 20 million Americans with older analog TVs from seeing these new release movies at all. That's because the order allows the studios to limit deliveries of new movies only to the households with newer digital sets. In addition, critics say the blocking technology could prohibit legal recordings on some video recorders and other devices with analog connections. We're unsure when the FCC has ever before given private entities the right to disable consumers' products in their homes, the Consumer Electronics Association said in a statement. The fact that the motion picture studio wants to create a new business model does not mean that functioning products should be disabled by them. Public knowledge, a media interest group, said the FCC has succumbed to the special interest pleadings of the big media companies. The FCC prohibits the use of so-called selectable output control technologies, which encodes video programming with a signal to remotely disable set-top box output connections. The FCC granted a waiver from those rules on Friday at the request of the MPAA. Allowing movie studios to temporarily prevent recording from TVs could pave the way for movies to be released to the home sooner than they are today. The FCC said the waiver is therefore in the public interest, because the studios are unlikely to offer new movies as soon as their theatrical release without such controls. I don't think so. Okay, the problem with this is, okay, what they're doing is they're turning off outputs on the boxes, like cable boxes, satellite dish boxes. They're turning off the analog ones, the RCA ones that go to older televisions, so that people with older television won't be able to see it. So what they're saying is that they're able to do this, they're able to offer new movies right away to people, because, you know, there's no fear of, you know, copying. But it's not the end user that is doing the ripping from television. These are highly skilled people that have done it for years, that have been worked around every single thing that the MPAA has thrown at them. They have been able to get perfect digital copies of everything every time. There's not one incident that they've been able to prevent somebody from doing that. And all it takes is one copy. They forget that it's not people en masse doing this. There's not people with VCRs out there taping their movies so they can pass it around to their friends. This, all it takes is one person to do one copy, one time, and it is everywhere. By clamping down on consumer rights to be able to time shift and store the video that they have paid for through their cable boxes and satellite boxes, it's not going to win any favors from the populace. If you are taking away control from people, it is not in their best interest. They're not going to like it. I don't see how they could keep spinning these stories to the governing bodies and convincing them that it's in the public's interest. And that's what the FCC said. It's in the public interest that this happen. But it's not in the public interest. It's in the MPAA's interest that this happens. But even further to that, it's in nobody's interest that this happens, because it does not prevent one iota of copying out there on the internet. There is no sneakernet doesn't happen anymore. People are not recording these movies through the analog outputs. They're getting perfect digital copies from anywhere they can. And it only takes one person, and it's out there. By inconveniencing the populace, you're not winning anybody over. I can see people running away en masse from MPAA-produced movies because of these limitations that they keep putting upon our devices, and people going to more and more, maybe, you know, amateur, independent films, films that don't put these restrictions. And I hope people look to what else is out there, and not just going for the Hollywood blockbuster movies, which are being locked down and restricted day by day by the studios, so that you can only view it on their newest television that you have to shell out thousands of dollars for, in the newest equipment, so they work hand in hand so that they can agree on some digital bits that they can turn on and off, whether they want you to view it at their convenience or not, and not at your convenience. Privacy news from the U.S. Privacy groups complain to FTC over Facebook privacy tweaks. Sent by Mind Inversion. Electronic Privacy Information Center, EPIC, is taking its beef with Facebook. I'm going to do a couple of Facebook news posts really quick here. I'm just going to glance through them so you'll get understand where they're coming from, because I have a whole bunch of things from Facebook, because it's a perfect example of privacy erosion on the internet for the public. Okay, taking its beef with Facebook's privacy policies to the Federal Trade Commission once again. A new complaint comes in the wake of Facebook's latest update to its privacy policy. According to Epic and 14 other consumer groups, Facebook's decision to open up even more personal information as public is a violation of user expectations. It diminishes privacy and it contradicts Facebook's own representations of how the service works. In the complaint, which was filed on Wednesday, the group accused Facebook of engaging in unfair and deceptive trade practices and violating consumer protection laws. In addition to the 38-page document submitted to the FTC, Epic also sent a letter to Congress asking members of the Senate and House to keep a close eye on the commission's investigation into Facebook. Facebook continues to manipulate the privacy settings of users and its own privacy policy so that it can take personal information provided by users for a limited purpose and make it widely available for commercial purposes, reads the letter. The company has done this repeatedly and users are becoming increasingly angry and frustrated. Now, this reminds me of the boiling frog story. Now, it's just a parable, and it's not based in reality at all, but it's a story about you put a frog in, you know, normal room temperature water, and you turn it up ever so slowly over time so that it doesn't notice that it's slowly being boiled alive and it therefore dies at the end. And that's what Facebook is doing to its users, eroding its users' privacy bit by bit so that people aren't even aware and they become more and more reliant upon the service, where at the beginning, like I outlined this last week with the gorgeous graphic that somebody came up with, the devolution of Facebook's privacy policies over time, showing more and more how it gets eroded further and further with each privacy erosion in its statements of privacy policies on its site, and it shows what you're losing each time. But each time people go, oh, that's just a little bit. Oh, that's just a little bit more, until it's come to this point where there is none left. Just about everything in your profile is for public consumption by third parties that can lay down a few dollars and know everything about you and your friends. And, you know, they can just buy you. They own you. They own everything about you. They know who you are. They know everything in your Facebook account. They own your personality. They can market to you however they want. And this is not what people signed up for in the beginning of Facebook. They thought in the beginning of Facebook, and it is outlined in their privacy policy, that nothing goes outside Facebook, and it got eroded to the point where everything goes outside of Facebook for the dollar. And more Facebook privacy news. How do I delete my Facebook account? A fast-growing query sent by DC. Facebook doesn't make it easy to delete your account, but a growing number of people appear to be turning to Google to find out how to do just that. Google suggests the drop-down box that offers suggested search query completions based on absolute and recent upticks of popularity now guesses that if you start typing "how do I," that you'd like to know how to quit Facebook. Note that deactivating your account, something that Facebook responds to in a pretty shocking way as well, is not the same as deleting it. I'll go on to the next story. That's just a funny little tidbit there. Actually, here it is. It's a quote from 1984, George Orwell's 1984, which people like to trot out anytime some company does anything bad. But it's this is not the government doing it. This is voluntary things. People are signing up for Facebook, and you can voluntarily sign out for Facebook too. But it's a funny little quote. It was terribly dangerous to let your thoughts wander when you were in any public place or within range of a telescreen. The smallest thing could give you away: a nervous tick, an unconscious look of anxiety, a habit of muttering to yourself, anything that carried with it the suggestion of abnormality, of having something to hide. In any case, to wear an improper expression on your face was itself a punishable offense. There was even a word for it in newspeak: face crime. George Orwell 1984. And I think they just brought it up because it adds the word face crime in, and it's very clever, you know. This next story, what happens when you deactivate your Facebook account? Now, most people don't know what happens when you delete their Facebook account, but because they haven't, and they haven't even gone to it, and they hide it pretty well and how to do it. Facebook is a big part of millions and millions of people's lives, but what happens when you pull the plug? Last night, I met a man who walked off the edge of the cliff and nearly deactivated his Facebook account. He took a screenshot of what he saw after clicking the Deactivate My Account link on his Facebook. On his account page, and it's pretty far out. That man considered quitting Facebook because it was having an adverse emotional impact on him, and I'll spare him and his contacts from posting the screenshot he shared with me. I've posted below a screenshot of the screen I saw when I clicked that button myself, and you can look at it on the page that I've linked to. Check it out. I bet you haven't seen the screen before, have you? Can you believe that? How incredibly manipulative. And what it has is a screenshot of three of his friends saying, "I'm going to miss you," written below it. And I'll keep reading. Facebook has undoubtedly made it easier to keep in touch with people than almost any other technology on the planet. But to say that leaving Facebook means your friends will no longer be able to keep in touch with you, in quotes, is just wrong. Facebook often says little things like this that read like it thinks it has a monopoly on human connection. Apparently, my wife's good friend and one of my coworkers are really going to miss me if I leave, though. The photo of Frederick, my coworker, that isn't even his profile photo. There's a photo where he and I were both tagged. At least it didn't say my wife was going to miss me. According to one report, adding these photos of friends is keeping 1 million people per year from deactivating their account. So I'm guessing they have statistics somewhere of people who have visited that page but didn't go through to completion of deleting their account and they backed off because of the manipulative tactics that Facebook has put on this page of putting up photos of your friends saying you're going to lose contact with your friends if you quit Facebook and showing photos of you and your friend together in the photo because both him and his friend were tagged in this photo. How manipulative of Facebook. But you know, they can do that. That's their prerogative to do that. And it's your prerogative to decide whether you've sold out enough to Facebook or not. One more to put the nail in the coffin, if it already hasn't been. Privacy news from the U.S. Well, these new Zuckerberg IMs won't help Facebook's privacy problem sent in by Random Hero. Facebook CEO Mark Zuckerberg and his company are suddenly facing a big new round of scrutiny and criticism about their cavalier attitude toward privacy. An early instant messenger exchange Mark had with a college friend won't help put those concerns to rest. According to SAI sources, the following exchange is between a 19-year-old Mark Zuckerberg and a friend shortly after Mark launched the Facebook in his dorm room. And this is all from, it says Zuck. "Yeah, so if you ever needed info about anyone at Harvard, just ask. I have over 4,000 emails, pictures, addresses, and SNS." Redacted friend's name. And this is a friend responding. "What? How did you manage that one?" Zuckerberg says, "People just submitted it. I don't know why. They trust me," in quotes. "Dumb fucks." And he goes on to say, "Brutal. That could Mark have been completely joking? Sure, but the exchange does reveal that Facebook's aggressive attitude towards privacy may have begun early on. Sure, since Facebook's launch, the company has faced one privacy flap after another, usual following changes to the privacy policy or new product releases. To his credit, the company has often modified its products based on such feedback. As a pioneer in such a huge new market, Facebook will take heat for everything it does. It has also now grown into a $22 billion company run by adults who know what their future depends on Facebook users trusting the site's privacy policy." But the company's attitude, and I read somewhere, it was an infographic about Facebook, and in 2004, I think, somebody, Yahoo offered Zuckerberg $1 billion for Facebook, and he turned it down. He knew what he had in Facebook way before it became massive. But the company's attitude for privacy is reflected in Mark's early emails and IMs. Features like beacon and instant personalization and the frequent changes to the privacy policy has been constantly aggressive. Do something first, then see how people react. Which, you know, that's exactly what they've been doing. So, you know, this may or may not be true. Facebook declined to comment about Mark's attitude toward privacy. So we don't know if these are real or fake, but you can decide on whether Mark Zuckerberg is what this kind of shows him to be. Worldwide copyright news. Google attorney slams ACTA copyright treaty. Sent in by DC. An attorney for Google slammed a controversial intellectual property treaty on Friday, saying it has metastasized from a proposal to address border security and counterfeit goods to an international legal framework sweeping in copyright and the internet. The Anti-Counterfeiting Trade Agreement, or ACTA, is something that has grown in the shadows, Gollum-like, without public scrutiny, Daphne Keller, a senior policy counsel in Mountain View, California, said at a conference Stanford University. Both the Obama administration and the Bush administration had rejected requests from civil libertarians and technologists for the text of ACTA, with the White House last year even indicating that disclosure would do damage to the national security. After pressure from the European Parliament, however, negotiators released the draft 2 weeks ago. And I guess national security went wild after it was released, and, you know, the USA was just bombarded with national security concerns, and no, there's nothing in there about national security. The international adoption of ACTA could increase the liability for internet intermediaries, such, perhaps, as search engines. Keller said, you don't want to play Russian roulette with very high statutory damages. One section of the ACTA says that internet providers disabling access to pirated material and adopting a policy dealing with unauthorized transmission of materials protected by copyright would be immune from lawsuits. If they choose not to do so, they could face legal liability. Fair use rights are not guaranteed. It looks a lot like cultural imperialism, Keller said at the Legal Frontiers in Digital Media Conference. It's something that really snuck up on a lot of people. Cultural imperialism. That's a beautiful phrase, and I hope I can memorize that one and use it later on. And that's really what is happening. Cultural imperialism. The corporations are locking down on the rights to use things that are in everyday society that we talk about, that we see all the time, but we're not allowed to use. We're turning into a read-only culture, like Lawrence Lessig said. And it is entirely frightening that how much control the corporations have over people. We are the peons, and they are the kings on high, handing down what we should consume and telling us what we can consume and what we can do with it, or what we can't do with it, in fact, because we can't do anything with it. As I'm going to show in this next article here, showing what we can't do with anything because they're going to lock it down to the frame of a video. You can't even put up one frame of a video anywhere now without somebody be able to analyze it and say that frame of that video is from my copyrighted movie. There is no fair use anymore. It's going down the drain because of what's happening around the world. Now, copyright news from the U.S. NEC announces video checking technology, centered by Mind Inversion. The technology creates a signature that is compared against one from the original file to determine whether the video has been altered. According to NEC, this will allow owners of the video to automatically detect illegal copies and prevent illegal upload of video content without their consent. NEC claims that each frame has its own signature, meaning that even minute changes to the file, such as adding subtitles, watermarks, or dog tags, and of course cutting out adverts, will alter the overall signature of the video. The firm touts the efficiency of its algorithm, saying that a bog-standard PC can search through 1,000 hours of video in just 1 second. Quite what the firm's definition of a home-class PC would be interesting to know, as we can't quite figure out how even a dual-core 3 GHz box can go through the 104 billion checks for the 1,000 hours of video in a mere second. NEC also claims that its technology will do away with the current manual checking by members of the movie industry and ISP to spot dodgy videos. While all this sounds great for the movie studios, technologies such as this are usually circumvented by the equally smart file-sharing community. The time it takes for the movie studios to adopt this latest technology in their never-ending battle against file shares will determine how quickly it is cracked. Nonetheless, the inclusion of NEC's video signature technology should mean that the MPEG-7 standard will finally step out from the shadows and get recognized by Hollywood executives who might choose to encode their future titles with it. So this, in combination with ACTA, this might be able to enforce any video hosting site on the internet to employ this technology so that it can check against a huge database of frame by frame encoded videos, so that any video posted to the internet will now be checked against a database and be taken down immediately off of the internet for any infringement at all down to the frame because of this technology. They're not talking about somebody searching on your home computer for this. They're talking about searching on the internet for this because they can do it now. And all the Hollywood studios are going to feed all their movies through this technology, do a frame by frame analysis, get a checksum, and be able to have a database of all the checksums of all their videos, 24 frames a second times 2 hours, add that up, not very much data in the scheme of things, multiply that by how many movies they have, and they've got a complete library catalog of every frame of every movie they've ever made, and be able to, you know, force through legislation video hosting sites such as YouTube to be able to take down every video, every frame of every video that somebody has ever made, and, you know, just do away with fair use, because computers don't know what fair use is or not. It's dictated by the corporations and the hosting site. If you have 3 seconds of video that's trying to make a point on a news show or some, you know, like the example where they had the movie Downfall with Hitler spouting off and people make parodies of that, those would be gone instantly, which they were already, but it's going to be even more succinct because those were large clips of Downfall. These are talking about frame by frame, even more frightening. You will be seeing everything controlled down to a walled garden of media corporations where they absolutely control everything. All of our culture is going to have to go through the security guards of media. Free speech news from the U.S. State court, internet filtering at libraries, constitutional. Sent in by Mind Inversion. Libraries will choose to filter internet access. That choose to filter internet access are not engaged in censorship, according to the Washington Supreme Court. The court made its decision late last week on a 6-3 vote, with the majority noting that libraries are not obligated to provide universal access to all constitutionally protected speech just because it exists. Still, the dissenting justices feel that the filter should be removed at the request of an adult, and that the decision is draconian. The case was originally brought against the North Central Regional Library by 3 patrons who found that they were unable to access certain sites on the library's computers. NCRL had implemented a policy as well as FortiGate filtering software across all its branches that barred access to certain kinds of content such as porn, gambling sites, web chat services, proxy avoidance tools, and other adult content. According to NCRL's policy, sites that were erroneously blocked could be unblocked at the request of an adult patron, but otherwise the filter remained in place even if adult were to request immediate access to certain forbidden sites. The patron, Sarah Bradburn Pearl Charles, said in their suit that NCRL's filtering policy was unconstitutional, particularly that part that barred adult patrons from requesting that the filter be lifted on the spot. After all, public libraries are just that, a public service, and barring access to sites like Women and Guns is not far off from China's Great Firewall, which blocks sites that talk about Tibetan liberation. Or is it? According to the Supreme Court judges, libraries like NCRL have to consider their resources when it comes to both printed and electronic materials. Even if one to assume a public library with unlimited funds and space, that library would be under no obligation to make all constitutionally protected printed materials available, wrote the judges. For example, regardless of its resources, a library need not place pornographic materials on its shelves, although such materials are constitutionally protected. Well, they're talking about two different things here. They're talking about the ability to stock books and to show sites, and the choice to block certain books and certain sites. Now, this filtering software blocks specific sites, a list of specific sites. Now, if the library, if you applied that exact terminology to books, therefore it would be a list of books that were not allowed to be viewed or not allowed to be put on the shelves in a library. Now, if you didn't know that a book was not on the shelf in the library, it was not in the card catalog, it was not in the search engine at the library to look up what books are available, and it was hidden underneath the library in a room that you didn't know existed, what were you to do? You wouldn't know that these books didn't exist. It is exactly like China's Great Firewall, where you don't know about the massacres that go on in Tiananmen Square because it doesn't exist. Nobody knows about it. It's being repressed because you don't know about it. How are you supposed to find out about something that you don't know about? You don't even know where to start because you don't know what's being hidden. It's just like these filtering software they're putting at the libraries. If you start typing in sites, something that you look at it on your home computer, and you go to the library and you start looking up that on the library, you go, I can't get to this site. This is very strange. You go to the librarian and you go, I can't get to this site. Oh, that's our filtering software. Let me unblock that for you because you're an adult. You have shown me your driver's license and proving your age, etc., etc., whatever they deem to be an adult. And she goes, there you go. Your site is unblocked. You can now go to the site because you're an adult. But if you have never been to the site before that is blocked arbitrarily on some secret list, you will never know that site existed. Maybe you need that information for researching something that to do in your life that is completely legal thing to look up as an adult in the United States, because it's where the story is from, something legal in the United States, but somebody arbitrarily, based on some moral standard, has blocked it from you because they don't agree with you seeing it unless you ask to see it. And now you've asked to see this site. Who says that you're not being logged looking at this site? Arbitrarily logged and say, well, five people requested to see this site. This is their library card number. Somehow they can track that against you, or they do because that's been implemented, but it's also secret. I'm just going off the deep end here, but you know, it boils down to really censorship. That's what it is. These are public libraries. This is the public good, and this is happening too. And this is something that is censorship because it is in the public. It is the public good. It's not a corporation. This is the United States of America, and it's a public good, the libraries. So this is a very good definition of censorship happening. Net neutrality news from the U.S. Telecom's secret plan to attack net neutrality, target video gamers, and stoke fear of Chinese censorship, sent in by Mind Inversion. Net neutrality, a guiding principle for preserving a free and fair internet, means that internet service providers are not allowed to discriminate based on content for its customers. However, telecommunication firms like AT&T, Verizon, Comcast, and others are firmly against net neutrality because they would like to increase their profits by deciding which websites customers can see and at what speed. The telecom industry has dumped hundreds of millions of dollars into lobby campaign against net neutrality, and the FCC has now taken up net neutrality rulemaking. The industry is pushing an outside approach of hiring front groups and astroturf operatives. Now, this is going to go on to say what their tactics are in trying to convince people that net neutrality is bad for the internet. And this is from a group called Americans for Prosperity, a group not directly associated with the ISPs. And Think Progress, where this story came from, has obtained a PowerPoint document which reveals how the telecom industry is orchestrating the latest campaign against net neutrality. So these are their bullet points on trying to convince the public and the government on why to not have net neutrality. Slides 7 and 8 call for the campaign to target libertarian-minded internet users and video gamers and social conservative activists with anti-government messages and a rebranding of net neutrality as net brutality. So they're going to go in the angle of government is bad. Government is trying to regulate the internet. Well, yeah, they will be trying to regulate the internet because they're trying to regulate AT&T, Verizon, and Comcast from slowing down certain sites so that they don't get to you for till fast speed unless you pay a little bit extra, and the corporations that are trying to, or the websites that you're trying to get to pay a little bit extra as well, so they go to the top of the heap, the fast tier, the fast lane of the internet. Superhighway. Slide 9 calls for a strategy of creating a Chinese blog to compare net neutrality to Chinese government censorship. Outreach via social networking platforms like Twitter and Facebook. So they're going to set up scare tactics comparing the U.S. government against the Chinese government, saying that net neutrality is somehow censorship, and saying that the U.S., by regulating the internet, is somehow locking down the internet from consumers being able to access what they want. And they really like to twist what net neutrality is all about. The ISPs, and they try and twist it so that they think that the government is trying to regulate what you see on the internet. Well, they're trying to regulate what you don't get to see on the internet. That's what they're trying. That's what I hope they're trying to do. That's what I hope the end result is. But if unchecked, the ISPs can do whatever they want, slow whatever services they want down, and whatever websites they want down. And slides 10 and 11 detail how representatives met at Grover Norquist's infamous Wednesday morning meeting to orchestrate the new campaign. Norquist is known to use his Wednesday meetings to plot strategy and conservative coalition building towards lobbying goals. Well, that's the other one. The other two are really showing how they're going to fight against net neutrality. Don't fall for their tactics that they're trying to pit the government against you, saying that the government is the bad guys. Well, on some level, sometimes they are, and sometimes the corporations are the good guys. Sometimes it's the opposite way around. But you can't put a blanket statement over a corporation or a blanket statement over the government saying it's completely 100% evil, and what they're trying to do is censor you off the internet. You have to look at exactly what they're doing, and not just the letter of the law, the intent of the law, and not just the letter of what these corporations are saying, but the intent and the reasoning behind what they're saying, and follow the money trail, because that's where it leads. It leads to the truth. A lesson on how to manipulate data and therefore people is really what they're teaching us. In worldwide copyright news, now, these are two stories that combine into one story, really, but two sides of the same coin, both sent in by Minded Version. He picked up on this. These stories were posted on exactly the same day on two different newspaper sites on the internet. News sites, there's no paper involved. One is Software Piracy Continues Global Rise, and the other one is Global Software Piracy Down Year Over Year. Now, which one is true? Well, it depends who you're talking to at what time. First one, where it says it continues to rise, software piracy around the world has risen again, according to a report from the Business Software Alliance, BSA. The industry body says that losses from the software piracy amounted to $51.4 billion in 2009. I wonder what all the citizens of the world are doing with all this money they're holding back from software and movies. It singled out, It singled out computer users in the Asia-Pacific region as the source of the biggest dollar losses in the world. Okay, so they're saying huge losses, $51 billion in losses this last year. Okay, next story, where they make money and the piracy is actually down, a business software alliance, an industry trade group that represents many software vendors, has made stamping out software piracy a major initiative. To that end, it commissions an annual survey of global piracy performed by IDC. There's not a whole lot of information about the methods employed producing those numbers, so it's difficult to know how reliable they are in absolute terms. But said figures may be valuable in detecting trends, in which case the news is good for the BSA. Although piracy remains substantial, it isn't growing at the rates it once was, and many industrial countries have seen rates of piracy drop below 25%. So, good news for the BSA, and bad news for the BSA, depending on who they're talking to and who their interests are. So if they're going to the government, they're going to say, piracy is on the rise, we need stricter restrictions, and we need to lock down on these pirates. And if they're going to go to their buddies and the people that are making the money, they're going to go to Microsoft, they're going to go to all the software developers, they're going to say, we're stamping out piracy bit by bit, you're making more money than ever before, piracy, these made-up numbers are going down year after year. It was $75 billion one year, and now it's only $51 billion lost this year. I don't know where these numbers come from. We know you would have botched Photoshop and Windows Vista. We know you would have done it. We saw it in your eyes. You would have bought that software. You owe us $600, or you would have. So we're going to put this on our tab and say that you would have bought it. And we're going to add that up to $51 billion, because that's what people want to hear. So the BSA can declare that piracy is rampant and justify enacting three strikes laws and draconian DRM. And then in the next report, we declare that the heroes, because their efforts have controlled the spread of copyright infringement. So congratulations and so sorry at the same time for the BSA. So in free music and media section, no music, but some media, Access Denied, a documentary on the Great Firewall of Australia plans. So what's going on in the Great Firewall of Australia's documentary on it from abc.net.au, not the ABC of the US, but ABC of Australia, sent in by DC. And he says, a bit of irony over that Access Denied documentary. When a North American tries to view it on their website, this is seen. Due to copyright reasons, the video program is available for download by people located in Australia only. If you're not located in Australia, you're not authorized to view this video. Sorry about that. Maybe it'll show up on Pirate Bay or ISO Hunt. Well, if you look at it right from the different, there's two different viewings. I looked it right on the page, and you're able to view it on the page. But if you follow the link to somewhere else, you're not able to view it. So keep searching around. I was able to view it in the same ISP that DC was. So. And privacy as a policy, political right, is all sent by DC. Just going to read a little bit out to you. A very, very interesting essay that you should go through and read about privacy. The Wall Street Journal reported recently on the protests in Iran that referred to YouTube footage of one female protester who was chanting at the police, take my picture, film my face, you can't silence me. I hope that is the case. I am doubtful, however, I wish we lived in a world where this was true. But it is likely she'll be found and there will be repercussions. In January, Iranian authorities warned that they will be monitoring emails and text messages to find anyone encouraging protests. In the same week, Google announced that hacking attacks from China were targeting the email accounts of human rights advocates. These cases remind me of a recent ominous speech by Stavros Lambridinis, a vice president of a European parliament. He was reminding an audience of international privacy experts of life under Greek military government. He recalled that the government at the time kept track of everyone's reading habits by monitoring their choices of newspaper. Through this, they were able to know a citizen's political leanings. There was a stark reminder of the chilling effect of surveillance in Europe's political history. It goes on. Very interesting read. Take a look at that. Closing words. The Canadian Coalition of Electronics Rights has updated its online writing wizard in light of recent developments of the Canadian Copyright Reform Front. This update is intended to address the government's seemingly willingness to ignore the voices of thousands of Canadians and proceed with the introduction of anti-consumer copyright reform legislation in as little as 6 weeks, as the Canadian DMCA, in quotes. Legislation that goes into a polar opposite direction of what Canadians demanded during the consultation process. Send your letter now and share this tool with your friends, family, and co-workers. Is it essential that we all speak up now while we have the opportunity? And this is from the Canadian Coalition for Electronic Rights, Senate by DC as well. It makes it easy to express your views. You can change their letter and send in something of your own, but it has a full list of the Canadian representatives that of your district, so you can send in your concerns about the Canadian copyright laws that are going into effect soon, with besides the consultation that they did going against what the Canadians spoke up about. So remember, if any of these stories have interested you, please check out your local pirate party to find out more about what you can do to help preserve your rights and freedoms. If you have any news stories you'd like to hear on the show, questions or comments, just head over to piratepartyradio.com and submit them through the forum on the website. And I would like to say congratulations to the Pirate Party of the UK for participating in the elections that just passed in the UK. They didn't get any seats, but the important is getting the word out and getting the recognition of the public that the Pirate Party exists, and hopefully influence either the public or the government, so the government can go to the Pirate Party for consultations on our internet freedoms and our electronic and privacy freedoms that we have now that are eroding. And hopefully they can influence even a little bit. It's not about getting seats, it's about influence. So thank you for listening. And until next time, this has been James O'Brien for Pirate Party Radio.